Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, Senior Counsel at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, we welcome in Marcia Wagner, founder of the Wagner Law Group and an expert in all things ERISA, to discuss the impact of the new DOL fiduciary rule on the investment management industry. In our headline section, we look at SEC recently proposed amendments to the electronic record keeping requirements and the new SEC enforcement report. And finally, we'll wrap up today's show with another installment of the Outtake series, where we once again learn the importance of being honest and transparent with investors when it comes to disclosures. Diving into the headlines portion of the show, the SEC recently proposed amendments to its electronic record-keeping requirements, specifically to its broker-dealer and security-based swap dealer electronic record-keeping requirements, most significantly doing away with the requirement that those records be kept in a non-rewritable, non-erasable format, also better known as Write One, Read Many, or WORM. The SEC stated in its proposing release that the current record-keeping rules do not accommodate contemporary electronic record-keeping systems. And so these proposed amendments are intended to, one, make the rule technology neutral, two, improve electronic record-keeping requirements, and three, further facilitate inspections and examinations. In place of the WORM requirement, the SEC would instead adopt an audit trail alternative, which would be defined as a record-keeping system which records all modifications to and deletions of a record or any part thereof, date and time of certain operator entries and actions that create, modify, or delete the record, the individuals creating, modifying, or deleting the record, and any other information that might be needed to maintain an audit trail of each distinct record in a way that maintains security, signatures, and data to ensure the authenticity and reliability of the record, and that will permit recreation of the original record when there's an examination present. In addition, the proposal would also allow for the following modifications to the existing rules. One, it would require broker dealers and non-bank security-based swap dealers to maintain electronic records either in WORM or in a system that meets the audit trail alternative requirement. It would also mandate that broker dealers and SBSDs produce electronic records through a reasonable, usable electronic method that enables securities regulators to be able to search and sort through that information. And finally, it would require that senior officers of a broker-dealer or SBSD have independent access to the firm's electronic records and be able to provide such records to securities regulators. SEC Chair Gensler really supported this rule proposal, stating that it would bring the regulation in line with technological innovation. Furthermore, SEC Commissioner Hester Peirce also praised the issuance of the proposal, saying that an update of the electronic record-keeping rule will reduce redundancy in firms' record-keeping systems and will help the SEC ensure that its, quote, regulatory framework is capable of accommodating technological change while continuing to advance the regulatory mandate that Congress has entrusted to the SEC, end quote. So what's the practical takeaway here? I think very often we talk about rulemaking in the sense of it's going to modernize or sometimes reform existing rules. That's not always the case, but I think in this particular instance, it certainly feels that way. There is no doubt that many of the registered entities out there that would be subject to the proposed rule are going to support that the new rulemaking and the alternative method. That said, it would do well for firms to make sure they read through all of the proposed amendments in order to provide effective feedback and commentary on the new rulemaking. Moving to our next headline, the SEC recently published its enforcement report, which hypes a volume of new actions and an increase in overall penalties. In the report, the SEC called attention to filing of over 450 new enforcement actions in fiscal year 2021. The new actions brought the total number of actions to 697, representing an increase of 7% over new actions brought in fiscal year 2020, but a decrease in overall actions compared with the prior 6 years. The report also found, oddly enough, a 33% decrease in disgorgements, compared against the prior fiscal year, but an exact percentage of 33% increase in the total number of fines. As outlined in the report, enforcement actions were brought in new and emerging areas of securities law, including digital asset exchanges and lending platforms, SPACs, and decentralized finance transaction counterparties. Whistleblower awards also grew to an unprecedented level in 2021. To comment on these numbers, SEC Enforcement Director Gurbil S. Gurwal said that the year included many critically important and first-of-their-kind actions. Chair Gensler also applauded the results as evidence of the SEC's willingness to pursue misconduct in the financial system, regardless of the parties involved or the complexity of the field, stating, quote, "The SEC's Enforcement Division is the cop on the beat for America's securities laws. As these results show, we go after misconduct wherever we find it in the financial system, holding individuals and companies accountable without fear or favor across the 100-plus trillion capital markets we oversee." So what's the practical takeaway here? The SEC's Enforcement Division is very hard at work, and compliance officers and legal practitioners everywhere would do themselves well not to forget it, particularly under new Chair Gensler, who seems to be taking a bit more aggressive approach than the prior chair. As we move into the interview section of today's show, I am incredibly pleased to welcome in Ms. Marcia Wagner, an expert on all things ERISA law and benefits and compensation related topics. Marcia is the founder of the Wagner Law Group, one of the nation's largest and most highly regarded law firms specializing in ERISA, employee benefits, and executive compensation, and has practiced in employee benefits law for over 35 years. She graduated summa cum laude from Cornell University, in the top 5% of all foreign students from the London School of Economics and from Harvard Law School. Ms. Wagner is an authority on qualified and non-qualified plans, fiduciary issues, deferred comp, and welfare benefit arrangements, with experience in plan design and drafting, compliance, tax planning, and consultation on all aspects of ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code. Ms. Wagner also serves as an expert witness in ERISA litigation. She's written hundreds of articles and 24 different books, and is highly sought after in lecturing series across a wide variety of different media outlets. We are so incredibly pleased to have her on today's program. Marcia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So, we got a number of different topics that we could really sink our teeth into today, but I think two that are particularly important for many folks in the investment management industry in particular relate to the DOL fiduciary rule and to pooled employer plans. But I think because of, you know, the fact that December 2021 is right around the corner, I can't believe where the time this year has gone, I think it's probably really beneficial for us and for our audience to dig into the DOL fiduciary rule 3.0 first. So maybe just to kind of kick things off and get the topic started, Marcia, tell us about, you know, who is an investment advice fiduciary?
Okay. So ERISA section 321A defines different types of fiduciary relationships. And the one we're most concerned about is called the five-part test. And it's with respect to rendering advice concerning securities on a regular basis pursuant to an agreement or an understanding that is going to be a primary basis upon which people rely and is particularized to the plan participant or to the plan demographic. Now, this regulation interpreting ERISA has been in effect since 1975. When defined benefit pension plans were king, there really were no 401k plans existent, and rollover advice was really not part of the analysis. Now, if a party is a so-called investment advice fiduciary in accordance with 321, the five-factor test, so-called, it would be subject to the prohibitions on self-dealing under ERISA section 406, which is where all of these rules matter when rubber hits the road.
Yeah. No, that's super helpful. And I like the way that you describe that as the kind of where the rubber hits the road, because I think, in fact, There has been some controversy, right, over the DOL's interpretation of an investment advice fiduciary. And so, you know, what is it? What is the controversy as it relates to that definition really all about as it's set forth first in the 75 regulation and then how it's being interpreted today?
Absolutely. Good question. Well, the text of the 1975 regulation has not changed, not one iota. The DOL's interpretation of the regulation has significantly changed. Interestingly, the proposed change in interpretation is set forth in the preamble to Prohibited Transaction Exemption 2020-02 and not in the text itself. The focus of the prohibited transaction class exemption is on rollover transactions and what it means to provide advice on a regular basis. Under the regulation, a party providing advice on a regular basis would seem to refer to advice provided on a fixed or even intermittent schedule, perhaps quarterly or semi-annually at committee meetings. But the Department of Labor is now reading the regulation in a very much more expansive sort of way. Now, the DOL has to acknowledge that a single discrete piece of advice to roll over assets from, say, a defined benefit plan to an IRA would not be advice provided on a regular basis and hence not fiduciary investment advice. However, and this is important, the Department of Labor emphasized that providing advice on a regular basis extends to the entire advice relationship. Specifically, it does not exclude from the definition the first instance of advice, such as the recommendation to roll over assets into an IRA when there's an ongoing advice relationship.
Got it. So that first instance of advice then is now you're not going to be able to have a particular exemption for that. So it's going to get covered. Were there other changes to the DOL's understanding of the five-part? I know you had mentioned the five-part test from 1975. Were there any other changes that would affect how we define an investment fiduciary?
Yes, although none is pronounced as a change in the understanding of so-called regular basis. Now, with respect to primary basis, the Department of Labor emphasized that the advice has to be a primary basis rather than the primary basis upon which people rely. A bar or a factor that I think most advisors would easily pass. How can an advisor say with a straight face, well, whatever I said wasn't even a factor in the decision that was being made? Now, with respect to the mutual understanding or agreement amongst the parties requirement, the DOL indicated that statements disclaiming a mutual understanding or forbidding reliance on advice as a primary basis for investment will be taken into account, but will not be determinative. In other words, any contractual disclaimer must be consistent with the conduct of the advisor. In the preamble, the Department of Labor indicated that it will consider the reasonable understanding of the parties based upon the totality of the circumstances, and that a written disclaimer will not trump the reasonable understanding of the parties. So, the DOL's modification of its position with respect to the definition of investment advice fiduciary was not, I want to emphasize, the only change in its position associated with Prohibited Transaction Exemption 2020-02. It also, and more explicitly, reversed its position with respect to rollover advice as set forth in Deseret letter.
Interesting. And I want to get it. There's a couple of things in there that I think would be great to get into. One, I'm thinking over the course of our conversation today, we'll get into that statement that's in the preamble about considering the reasonable understanding of the parties, you know, based on the totality of the circumstances. But I guess maybe to start, because you just mentioned it, and I think obviously for our conversation today, it's critically important. Talk about the Deseret letter. What exactly did the Deseret letter say?
Sure. The Deseret letter is also known as DOL Advisory Opinion 2005-23 Cap A. And it was issued to Deseret Mutual Fund Administration. And it addressed whether an advisor that recommended an IRA rollover to a plan participant would be considered an investment advice fiduciary, and whether a management fee or other compensation received by this advisor from investments in an IRA would violate the prohibited transaction rules. Now, with respect to both questions, the DOL took the position that this advisor would not be acting as an investment advice fiduciary, even if the advisor provided advice on how to invest the distributed funds, as long as the advisor was not previously engaged by the plan participant to render investment advice or the plan sponsor. The DOL letter also opined that a person who was already a plan fiduciary could not respond to a participant's questions regarding distribution or amounts withdrawn from a plan without exercising fiduciary authority or control over the participant's accounts. However, the DOL concluded in this proposed prohibited transaction exemption that the Deseret letter was wrongly decided, with the result that almost all rollover recommendations would be fiduciary in nature, regardless of whether the advisor had or had not a pre-existing relationship with the plan.
So there's that seems like an incredibly broad expansion of rollover recommendations and whether or not the entity providing them are going to be fiduciary, whether the recommendations would be fiduciary in nature. And just again, in general, the fact that it's happening potentially, I think if I heard you right, even before a formal agreement is in place also seems like a pretty dramatic change. But so what tools would, if I'm an advisor then, if I'm someone that could potentially be considered an investment advice fiduciary, what types of tools do I have at my disposal? Do I have certain exemptions and other types of items that I might be able to use to help, again, mitigate those instances where I might be deemed to be an investment advice fiduciary?
Sure. The main tool you have is Prohibited Transaction Class Exemption 2020-02. Now, this was originally scheduled to become effective actually February 16th, 2021, but as I will be discussing, it's not currently fully in effect. Now, this is a prohibited transaction class exemption issued by the Department of Labor that covers prohibited transactions resulting from rollover advice, advice on how to invest assets within a plan or an IRA, and advice on whether to engage in certain principal transactions. The exemption allows investment advice fiduciaries to employee benefit plans and IRAs to receive otherwise prohibited compensation, including commissions, 12B1 fees, revenue sharing, markups, and markdowns in certain instances.
So in those scenarios, I guess, what exactly does, or maybe here's a better way to phrase it. What exactly is Prohibited Transaction Exemption 2020-02? What exactly is it designed to protect?
Okay, so this exemption is intended to protect retirement investors, which would be a participant or a beneficiary who has the authority to direct the investment of assets in his or her account and to take distributions, or the beneficial owner of an IRA acting on behalf of his or her own IRA, and the fiduciary of a plan or an IRA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I guess when it comes to the types of plans that are going to be covered by PTCE 2020-02, by the exemption, we've talked a bit about, IRAs. I imagine those would be covered. What other types of accounts would be covered underneath the exemption?
Sure. Any and all tax qualified plans, be it defined benefit, defined contribution, or hybrid, IRAs, including individual retirement annuities. And I want to make it clear that that includes simple IRAs and SEP IRAs. And to the extent they still exist out there, and grandfathered form, by the way, SARSEPs. And if any of you have them, you should call me because they're much more complicated than you realize. Archer Medical Savings Accounts, Health Savings Accounts, so HSAs, and Coverdell Educational Savings Accounts, which was the predecessor to 529 plans. Now, types of plans that would be excluded, and that's also important, in other words, there is no protection, are non-electing church plans, governmental plans, and non-qualified deferred comp plans, such as SERPs and top hat plans, et cetera.
So if certain types of plans are, you know, excluded from the definition of those accounts that are covered, on the flip side, I imagine that there's probably only they're not going to be able to provide the relief to everybody either. So when it comes to being able to avail yourself of this relief, are there certain types of persons who would be, you know, eligible for it versus others?
Yeah, I'm going to take that and make it into two questions, if you don't mind. Who is eligible for the relief and who is ineligible for the relief, if that's okay?
Yeah, great.
So eligible parties would include financial institutions and their investment professionals. Financial institutions include investment advisors, broker-dealers, banks, insurance companies, and the same type of entity as an entity receiving an individual prohibited transaction exemption under 2020-02, as well as their affiliates and related parties. In other words, certain entities that are quite large may look for their own individual exemption according to these terms. Now, the type of investment advice fiduciaries that are ineligible would include discretionary fiduciary investment arrangements, such as 338 investment manager relationships. The second would be for pure robo-advice. The third would be for plans for which the advice fiduciary or an affiliate is the employer of the employees participating in the plan, and similarly for plans in which the advice fiduciary is the named fiduciary. And finally, for financial institutions and investment professionals that within the last 10 years were convicted of certain crimes or who engaged in a systemic or intentional violation of this particular prohibited transaction exemption, and or who have made materially misleading statements to the Department of Labor in relationship to their conduct under this exemption. So when the DOL audits, as it inevitably and invariably will, exemptive relief can be lost in toto if there are materially misleading statements. So it's very important that you engage with ERISA counsel during at least the initial audits in this area.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree that in those situations, it's going to be really beneficial to have folks that are going to be, you know, intimately familiar with exactly kind of the best way to respond to those types of audits and questions. You brought up something, though, that's interesting. We actually just finished up our last episode of the Compliance and Context podcast, where we got to interview representatives from FINRA's OFI office and from the SEC's FinHub office. And one of the areas of their purview is actually on the robo-advisor side, right? Which, I mean, people hear OFI and they hear FinHub and they immediately think crypto, right? They immediately think digital asset, DEPs and gamification and all other kinds of stuff. But I guess I'd like to dig into that robo piece a little bit, because I think it'd be good to cover some of that. So with respect to the exemption for, you know, robo advice, I'm wondering about the connection with the advice that's there between the computer model and the personal interaction with an investment professional. And so for those organizations that I guess would like to try to adhere as close as possible to pure robo advice, I guess, would you have any guidance for those robo advisors on like the threshold, right, on the minimum amount of personal interaction with an investment professional that would allow them to utilize the prohibited transaction exemption?
That guidance has not been provided to date, and it is unlikely that any additional guidance by the DOL will be addressing that in the short or even in the medium term. Now, if the personal interaction is simply to serve as the proverbial kind of yes man for the computer-generated advice, I would think that might come within the four corners of the exemption. But I would be hesitant and very careful, and I would bring in legal counsel before relying on that minimal level of personal interaction in order to rely on that exemptive relief. I would be very careful to you robo-advice users out there, and you should probably get legal advice, personalized legal advice.
Right. Well, I can definitely tell you that with regard to the fallout from many of this, the new DOL fiduciary rule, some of its own promulgations, and then the reactions from many of my financial institution folks and advisors and brokers I support, really, I think the focus has been on rollovers. And so I guess, you know, one quick question for you that I know would be very relevant for a lot of our listenership here is, you know, what types of transactions did the Department of Labor actually treat as a rollover?
Yeah, that's a good question. The DOL treated five different types of transactions as rollovers, even though some of them would not and do not constitute rollovers under the Internal Revenue Code. So basically, rollover has a certain definition under ERISA, and now it has a certain definition under the Internal Revenue Code, just to make things even more complicated in this complicated area.
Perfect. Yeah, good.
It's like, yeah, they had to use the same word. So a rollover would include transfers plan to plan to IRA, IRA to plan, IRA to IRA, and commission-based account to fee-based account.
Got it. All right. Well, with that as context, I guess then the natural next question I'm going to figure out is, so what can our listeners do? What conditions must they meet in order to satisfy so that they too can come under the prohibited transaction exemption?
Sure. Now, to satisfy the prohibited transaction exemption 2020-02, financial institutions and investment professionals must acknowledge their fiduciary status in writing, disclose their services in material conflicts of interest, adhere to impartial conduct standards. I'm going to underline that, that's very important. Adhere to impartial conduct standards, adopt policies and procedures prudently designed to ensure compliance with the impartial conduct standards, document and disclose specific reasons why any rollover recommendations are in the participants' best interest, and conduct an annual retrospective compliance review.
Got it. I heard in your answer to that one that you were highlighting the impartial conduct standards. And so maybe I'll follow up on that a little bit and ask you if you would to flesh that out a little bit. Why the large focus on the impartial conduct standards?
You got my hint on what I wanted to follow up question to. The impartial conduct standard requires the fiduciary to give advice that is in the best interest of the retirement investor, to charge no more than reasonable compensation and comply with federal securities laws regarding best execution, and to avoid making misleading statements about investment transactions and other relevant matters. The best interest component of the impartial conduct standard itself has two components, a prudence component and a loyalty component. The prudence component requires the financial institution or the investment professional to investigate and to evaluate investments, provide advice, and exercise sound judgment in the same way that a knowledgeable professional would. And the loyalty component mandates that the financial institution or the investment professional does not place its or their interests ahead of the interests of the retirement investor or subordinates the retirement investor's interests to their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's also really helpful background. It makes me think, though, that there's going to have to be, with every institution and every investment professional, a bit of calculus that's going to have to go on with regard to the factors that are in play, right? And then documenting those different factors in probably a variety of different capacities. And so I guess, you know, what would you say? Because again, this is probably going to be one of those fantastic practical takeaways for many of our listeners. As you know, if you haven't already, now's a really good time to start to prepare this documentation so that you're ready to document why a determination to roll over from a tax qualified plan to an IRA was made. And so I guess in that type of analysis, Marcia, what would be some of the key factors that you would expect that financial institution and that investment professional to take a look at?
Sure. The financial institution or the investment professional needs to take into account the investment objectives, risk tolerance, financial circumstances, and needs of the retirement investor. More specifically, the factors should include the range of investment options available under the plan and IRA, the retirement investor's satisfaction with low-cost institutional funds if they're available under the plan, services offered under the plan and IRA, such as, for example, educational materials, planning tools, and investment advice, the potential for penalty-free withdrawals from the plan between ages 55 and 59 and a half that would not be available under an IRA, the potential for penalty-free withdrawals under an IRA that would not be available under the plan, the alternatives to rollover, including leaving the money in the plan, the availability of loans from the plan, the differences in protection for plan versus IRA assets from creditors, from judgments, from liens, differences in the required minimum distribution rules, whether the plan is invested in employer securities, weighing the tax consequences of rollover versus diversification risk, the fees and expenses associated with both the plan and the IRA, and whether, and last but not least, the plan sponsor pays for some or all of the plan's administrative expenses. Mm-hmm. I think a form should be created listing everything that I just mentioned and anything else that someone might think of as reasonable and relevant.
Yeah, I think, one, there's a lot of fantastic information there. And I totally agree with your final statement as well that, you know, well, and the other thing I'll add is that is a healthy list, right? Like that is there are a lot of factors in there that, again, indicate, I think, the importance of making sure your firm is prepared to kind of, and that your investment professionals and financial advisors and other folks that are involved in that process are adequately trained, I guess is maybe the phrase I would use on that front. But in addition to that, and look, this is a mantra that I hear and use a lot with, you know, many of our advisors, probably a bad joke in there about the fact that lots of compliance officers probably sound like a broken record, right? Repeating the same five or six songs over and over again. But one of them is this, which is that like, if there's something that is particularly important to the advisory services and the way in the provision of those advisory services to your clients, if that's something that you're, again, like actively taking into consideration when you're going through the portfolio management of an account and the recommendations you provide it, it should probably be on this list too, I would think, in a way that again, that's going to show the Department of Labor, that's going to show anybody viewing that form, that checklist that you mentioned, Marcia, that you've taken this seriously, and that you've also tailored it and made it unique to your firm. And I think that's important. It actually leads to another question I have for you, though, if I can put you on the spot to dig in even further into that possible recommendation that's occurred, right? And again, it's going to be probably number one for many of our listeners on that are listening to today's show. But what are some of those factors then that an investment professional, someone who, again, is getting ready to potentially tell that retirement investor, you should really consider transferring, you know, your assets from one IRA to another, or I guess, you know, in the broker dealer sense where you may be, or a dual registrant sense where you're moving from more of a commission based account to now a more fee based account.
All right. Here too, as in determining whether a retirement investor should roll over assets from a tax qualified plan to an IRA, the financial institution or investment professional really has to take into account the retirement investor's investment objectives, risk tolerance, and financial circumstances and needs. In addition, they should document the services available under the new arrangement. Consider the long-term impact of any increased costs. Determine why the rollover is appropriate, notwithstanding any additional costs, if any, and the impact of any economically significant investment features, such as surrender schedules, index annuity caps, and participant rates.
So if the requirements of the exemption are not satisfied there, like let's say, again, like you've gone through that entire analysis, you've weighed, you know, the factors in determining whether or not you recommend a rollover to a tax qualified plan to an IRA, whether you're going to then recommend the retirement investors roll over assets from one IRA to another, or again, from that commission-based account to a fee-based account. But let's say when you go through the calculus, you don't feel, let's say as you're trying to apply the PTCE 2020-02 to the services you're providing, you don't feel like the requirements of the exemption are satisfied. Is there anything else that you can do at that point that would help remedy the situation and again, try to keep the firm on the right side of the fence?
I would say yes, to a limited extent. The exemption permits corrections to be made within 90 days after the financial institution learns or should have learned of the violation. The financial institution must notify the Department of Labor within 30 days of the correction and must also notify the person responsible for conducting the annual retrospective review. Finally, the violation and the correction must be specifically set forth in a written report of the retrospective review. In other words, full and complete transparency.
Got it. So a part of the reason why I think a lot of firms may have been looking at this, or maybe I should say, using the time available between when some of these rules initially were discussed, promulgated, and made effective versus when they're now going to be enforced, is because the Department of Labor has had a non-enforcement policy with regard to PTCE 2020-02. When is that scheduled to end? And, you know, what should firms do in the interim to try to prepare for that ending?
I'm going to give you a long answer to this question. All righty. So following the decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit that vacated the Department of Labor's 2016 fiduciary rule that was called the BIC exemption, the DOL issued Field Assistance Bulletin 2018-02, which was a temporary non-enforcement policy which provided relief to investment advice fiduciaries who worked diligently and in good faith to comply with the best interest contract exemptions impartial conduct standard. So you need to comply with the impartial conduct standard now. It was originally intended to expire on December 20th of this year, i.e. 1 year after its publication in the Federal Register. However, literally yesterday, you can't say we're not on top of this. Today, the Department of Labor issued Field Assistance Bulletin 2021-02, which really modified the previous compliance date in two ways. First, for the period from December 2021 through January 31st, 2022, the Department of Labor will not pursue prohibited transaction claims against investment advice fiduciaries who are working diligently and in good faith to comply with the impartial conduct standard for transactions that would have been exempted under PTC 2020-02. And that is a good thing. Comply with the impartial conduct standard now. Second, the DOL will not enforce the specific documentation and disclosure requirements for rollovers that are contained in 2020-02 through June 30th of 2022. All other requirements of the exemption are subject to full enforcement as of February 1, 2022. Now, this updated temporary enforcement policy applies to the IRS as well. The IRS and DOL jointly agree on these deadlines. Now, please note that this non-enforcement policy, by its terms, only applies to the Department of Labor and the Internal Revenue Service. So private individuals and state regulators are not precluded from bringing actions.
Got it. So your local state regulator and the plaintiff's bar still have some leeway there. But I suppose that is some good news, because it does sound like for a lot of the various parts of the exemption, industry participants, again, if they're acting in good faith and they're trying to comply with the rules, are going to be given some grace there, I think, which
I believe that's true.
Yeah.
I believe what you said is accurate.
That's good. Well, so ultimately, some of these, you know, the stays on the enforcement period and stuff are going to come to an end. And I guess at that point, you know, what insight could you provide our audience on how violations of the prohibited transactions would be enforced?
Yes. On an overall basis now, the Department of Labor has investigative and interpretive compliance authority with respect to this particular prohibited transaction exemption in 2020-02. Now, with respect to Title I plans, plan participants, beneficiaries, and fiduciaries can bring actions under ERISA. It's ERISA Section 502, which is the civil enforcement section under ERISA. With respect to non-Title I plans, such as KEO plans, IRAs, or owner-only plans, if the Department of Labor determines that the conditions of the exemption have not been satisfied, the Department of Labor can and will notify the IRS, which can enforce failures to comply with the exemption by imposing excise taxes under Internal Revenue Code Section 4975. However, there can be no contractual or warranty claims with respect to compliance. There can be no expansion of a retirement plan investor's rights to sue in court, and no new legal claims can be created. Now, the Department of Labor may have desired to go further in creating enforcement rights for individuals, but the Department of Labor was required to comply with a decision in the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, which had invalidated the prior iteration of the investment fiduciary rule, in part because it sought to provide a so-called private right of action to affected plan participants on enforcement rights under IRAs, for example, or KEO plans that were not provided by Congress under ERISA or the Internal Revenue Code. So I think that it's going to get murky, but we're going to have to, until the statute changes, follow the Fifth Circuit's ruling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's really helpful background, and I know...
Thank you.
You know, many of our listeners are, you know, going to hopefully take some of the information provided in this podcast. If they haven't already, which hopefully they've already started to prep some materials, certainly that would be something that they would want to jump on, even though, again, to what you say, that there's going to be essentially a little bit of a good faith grace period. Firms should not sit on their laurels in any respect, and should really, again, if they haven't already, get moving now as they look to prepare for compliance with the rule.
Absolutely.
Well, again, Marcia, I so appreciate your providing this incredibly helpful background on multiple areas of ERISA law that are impacting the investment management space and many of our legal practitioners and compliance officers that are out there. So thank you so much for all of those valuable insights. I'm going to get you out of here maybe on something that is equally as fun as ERISA code and tax law. Maybe
that's going to be hard to do, man.
Well, we'll see what we can do. So on that front, one question that we've been asking a lot of our guests of late, and certainly I'm doing out of for my own selfish benefit, is as we get closer to some of the colder months, and there's probably a little bit more time indoors rather than outside. Is there a particular a TV show or movie that you have seen recently that you very much enjoyed, or a particular book that you also enjoyed that you could recommend to our listeners?
I just finished the best book in the world. I just finished reading Seneca's Letters to Lucilius.
Okay.
And even though he wrote like 2,000 years ago, it was so, I felt like Seneca was talking to me. And so that has inspired me to read a lot of the Stoics. So yeah. The next guy I'm going to go after is Marcus Aurelius.
There you go.
And I'll likely probably then go in more in depth with maybe Epictetus, maybe Plato, maybe Aristotle. But that's kind of the genre now that I'm finding extraordinarily interesting. But to everyone out there, I cannot tell you the joy and the wisdom I got from reading Seneca.
Okay. So that's awesome.
That to you.
Well, no, that's, I appreciate you commending that to our listeners. I will tell you that one of our closing segments very often on the Compliance and Context podcast is a little bit I like to call History Has Your Back. I'm a big fan. One of our prior episodes actually focused on letters from Caesar to Cicero during the great Roman Civil War. So no, that's good advice. I may take you up on that. Again,
Moshe. I'm also learning a lot about the Byzantine era, particularly how the capital of Byzantine, actually, as you know, it was Constantinople, and how that was really very Greek in many ways, and how the Greeks in that land really considered themselves the real successors to the Roman, the real Romans.
Sure.
And I found that very interesting. I also find very interesting that the beginning of the interplay between culture and civilization clashes of East versus West.
Yeah.
The Byzantine Empire, I find extraordinarily interesting. And I find it extraordinarily interesting the Greek Orthodoxy, how the religion itself developed separate and apart from Roman Catholicism. So that portion of our world, in our life, in our history, I think in some ways is not valued as much today. But the lessons to be learned from history in that respect are so apropos currently. And we can make or not make the same mistakes over and over again, depending on if we look at the wisdom of the philosophers and the lessons of history. So that's what I would commend to people listening.
Well, thank you for all of it. Thank you for being so gracious with your time to come on the show. Thank you for the wonderful, wonderful background and details on the DOL fiduciary rule and for your recommendations on things to do over the winter. Have a wonderful rest of your week and day, and look forward to having you back on the podcast here at some point down the road.
Thank you very, very much.
The final part of today's show features another installment of our outtake segment. As a quick reminder for some of our new listeners, if compliance were a TV show, think of this as the bloopers reel, where we look at entertaining, sometimes humorous, and always unsettling activities carried out at financial services firms that hopefully provide us with a roadmap of what not to do when facing a similar situation or trying to avoid a similar compliance breakdown inside our respective firms. Essentially, leave these activities on the cutting room floor and outside your compliance program. In today's Outtakes, we're looking at some mutual fund executives who misled investors by misrepresenting the investment risks in funds that ultimately suffered $1 billion in trading losses. Earlier this year, the SEC filed a civil action alleging that an investment advisor and its portfolio managers fraudulently misled investors and the board of directors of a fund they advised about risk management practices and the level of risk inside the firm's portfolios. According to the SEC's complaint, the firm adopted a short volatility trading strategy that carried risks that were remote but extreme. The complaint further alleges that in order to ease investor concerns about the potential for losses, the firm made a series of misstatements to investors and the mutual funds board about the firm's risk management practices, including false statements about its use of historical event stress testing and its commitment to maintaining a consistent risk profile instead of prioritizing returns. Among other things, the firm lied to investors about the, quote, worst case daily losses to expect from the strategy and falsely promised to maintain, quote, a consistent risk profile, end quote. The complaint further alleges that beginning in late 2017, during a period of historically low volatility, the firm actually increased the level of risk in the portfolios in order to chase return targets while falsely assuring investors during that time frame that the portfolio's risk profiles remain stable. According to the complaint, the market suffered a large spike in volatility, resulting in catastrophic trading losses exceeding $1 billion, or more than 80% of the value of the funds the firm managed over just two trading days. So what's the key lesson here? Well, it's no hidden secret. Make sure your firm, including if you are a mutual fund or private fund advisor, that your firm is being truthful and transparent with investors about how they manage risk. Here, the firm exposed investors to far greater risk of loss than the investors could have ever imagined. And now everyone, including the firm itself and its senior leaders, are paying the price for that. And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Calfee and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guest, Marcia Wagner, for coming on today's show to share her expertise about the new DOL fiduciary rule. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast, or on Twitter using the handle @CompliancePod. You can like us and subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceInContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.